We're doing our parsha class. We'll do a quick overview, and then we'll review the parsha Be'ezrat Hashem with more depth. The parsha begins with the mitzvah of appointing judges and policemen, and the responsibility that the judges be honest and not accept any form of a bribe, even if they say, I know what I'm going to rule, the bribe won't affect me, it doesn't work that way. Then the parsha tells us about our responsibility to pursue justice, to pursue an honest judge. The Torah warns us that we're not allowed to plant trees by the altar the way the pagans would. We're not allowed to set up a one-stone altar the way the pagans would. We're not allowed to take a blemished animal and say, hey, that's good for God. Hey, let me donate that. You know what people do. When the shoes are all worn out, that's when they give them to the poor. When the clothing are no longer good for me, that's when I can give them to the poor. So people would have the same eye. What do people do? They bring their worn talis to shul. That's not the approach. So people. So the Torah says, don't give Hashem the blemished animals. Torah says, if you find someone in your midst who does go the pagan route, and then you have a responsibility to verify if it's true, and if it's true, so then the person has to be forewarned, and if the person continues doing this in the presence of the witnesses who warned him, then he can actually get the death penalty. Notice how kind the Torah is. You will only get the death penalty if you did the action willfully, and there were witnesses present who warned you before you did the action. If you do that, you will get the death penalty. So you'll ask yourselves, when would a person ever do that? So imagine for a minute a kidnapper, okay? The kidnapper kidnaps two adults and a child, three adults. And he tells one of them, he says, now I want you to make me toast. And the other two tell him, if you make him make you toast, you will get the death penalty for that. Because the Torah says that if you kidnap someone and you make him work on your behalf, you get the death penalty. And he says, I'll be quiet. You can imagine that happening, right? And then imagine the police walk in and they take him into custody. Well, he will get the death penalty. You have two witnesses present, and they told him, if you do it, you'll get the death penalty. Same idea. Imagine he grabs two people, and he ties him up, and then he goes to rape a married woman. And they tell him, if you do this, you'll get the death penalty. And he says, be quiet. You can imagine that would happen. Well, he'll get the death penalty. That is the halacha. So there can be instances where a person transgresses and he gets a death penalty. If he was warned directly before he did it by the two witnesses that if you do this, you will get the death penalty. So that's when a person can get the death penalty. Torah says, what happens if you're uncertain about what the halacha is? So then there is a high court, and you go up to that high court, and they will explain to you how to understand the Torah. They will instruct you, and you have to listen to them. This is the source for rabbinic power. These verses tell us that the rabbis have the power and the responsibility to understand the Torah, interpret the Torah, and it's binding. What happens if one elder says, I know the rabbi said this, but I say different? So they went to the high court in the days of the temple, and he comes back home and he says, I know the high court said that you're allowed to shave with a machine, but I say it's biblically prohibited. So he rules against the high court. Now, he went to the high court and they told him he's wrong, and then he goes back to town and he rules against them. Well, then he gets the death penalty. That's called a rebellious elder, a Zaken Mamre, but he's a big rabbi. But the Torah says you can't do that. There's a halachic system, and you're not allowed to rebel against it. You can argue your case, you can argue with the rabbis, but at the end of the day, when the high court gives a ruling, you are not allowed to give people halachic ruling against the high court. Torah says, when you come to the land of Israel, you'll say, I want to appoint a king. Torah says, you can do that, but it has to be a Jew. You're not allowed to appoint a non-Jew. The king has limitations. He's not allowed to have too many horses, only what he needs, because that would lead him to connect us back to Egypt, because Egypt was the source of the best horses. He's not allowed to have too many wives, because that'll confuse him. He won't be pure in his thought. He's not allowed to have too much money. If he amasses too much wealth, then that'll misguide him. He has a special mitzvah to write another Sefer Torah. Every Jew has a mitzvah to write a Torah scroll. The king writes another one, and it's a small one, which he carries with him all the time. Just like we'd wear tefillin, the king would wrap to himself this small Sefer Torah, and he would read it on a steady basis, and that's in order to help him maintain, to keep the Torah. The Torah says that the priests are not entitled to a portion of the land of Israel, because they have other responsibilities within Israel. They have a responsibility to educate the people, to guide the people. The Torah says they get gifts. Every time you slaughter an animal, the priest, the Kohen, is supposed to get a part of the cheek, a part of the stomach. They get the first crops. They get the first shearing when you shear wool. So they get gifts, but they're not supposed to have part of the land. The Levites also have a portion, special gifts that they get. Torah says when you come to the land of Israel, don't learn from the pagans. You're not allowed to do their sorcery. You're not allowed to take your child and pass him through fire. There used to be an ancient custom, Maimonides writes, that when a baby was born, they'd wave him around a candle. They'd have a lit candle and wave him around the candle. So it was a superstitious thing. In India, they still do this. Yeah, okay. Rambam says that's a form of this biblical prohibition. It's a form of this pagan custom. Rambam says that's why they did this. They used to have a type of sorcery that you could, I don't know what they did, but like the Pied Piper, they could put together all the animals. They could get together all the snakes. They could get together all the mice. That's a biblical prohibition. It was a type of sorcery. There were ways to access the dead, ask them questions. Torah says that's prohibited. And we will discuss whether any of these were real or they were all fake. We'll get back to that. Hashem says, that's why I'm kicking the people out of the land. I don't want you to do this. I want you to be connected to me and have faith in me. I'm running the show. Torah says, I will give you prophets just like Moshe, and you will listen to him. And if you don't listen to him, so then Hashem says, a person who doesn't listen to him, Hashem will give him the death penalty. What happens if a prophet tells you something that God didn't say? So he gets the prophet gets the death penalty. You'll ask yourself, how do I know? So when the prophet tells you something's going to happen and it doesn't happen, so you know he lied. So then you execute him. Hashem says, when you conquer the land of Israel, you set up three cities of refuge. If a person killed by mistake, so then he has to run away to one of those cities of refuge. And he has to stay there. And that's what happens if a person murders on purpose. If you know he murdered on purpose, then going to the city of refuge won't give him any refuge. So then we'll take care of him. Torah says, be careful. Don't move the border between you and your neighbor. That's a form of theft if you encroach other people's property. Gentlemen, if you intend to live in Yeshuvim, so sometimes this is a big temptation. People tell themselves, you know, it's become very public because there was a person who was supposed to be chief of staff here in Israel, and it was discovered that he did this. A few years ago, it was discovered that he extended his porch. People think that if I steal from public domain, that's kosher. I don't know why. I'm stealing from the government. It's okay. Why is that okay? So instead of stealing from an individual, you're stealing from everyone. Okay, so that's something to think about. Torah says you're not allowed to have a single witness. There always has to be a minimum of two. And then the Torah gives us the story of what happens if two people testify and it turns out they were liars. So there can be an instance where they will get the punishment they tried to inflict on others. We'll discuss the details of that. That's called an eid zomim. Torah says if you go to war and you see a huge nation against you and you're very scared, don't be scared. That's a mitzvah. Rambam quotes it as a mitzvah. That's a very important mitzvah. Those of you who intend to join the armed forces, remember this. You're not allowed to be scared. That means you have to take control of your thoughts, your emotions. And then the Kohen, we establish a special Kohen who gives a special speech when we go to war. He says, don't be scared. Hashem is fighting on your behalf, and he will save you. And then we say, okay, who built a new house and never got to settle it? Who married a new wife? Who planted a new vineyard? You guys can go home. We don't want you to be thinking about your personal interests. War is a public thing. War isn't a personal thing. When you could connect to the public needs, then you could be above fear. When you're busy thinking, what's going to be with my new house? What's going to be with my new wife? You can't be a good soldier. Part of being a good soldier is to be able to detach from my personal needs and focus on the public good. That's what I'm doing as a soldier. So when we'd go to war, if any person was seen running away from war, then he could be killed. Because we say that when you start running, you're endangering everyone. Panic could endanger anyone. The whole army's in danger. Because once one person retreats, then everyone's going to start retreating. Everyone will say, oh, we're losing. And that's when you start losing a war. At the end of the parasha, we are taught that when we go to war, we first offer them peace. We ask them, if you want to be at peace with us, you'll pay taxes. We don't go to war if you don't want. You want to go to war? So then we go to war. Torah says when you go to war, you can lay siege on a city and enjoy the loot when you are victorious. In the cities of the land of Israel, be careful, because if you leave anyone around, then they will be eternal enemies, and they'll always fight you, and that's what happened. We left people around, and they ultimately were our enemies. The Torah gives us the mitzvah of Bal Tashchis. Don't destroy unnecessarily. You're laying siege on a city. Don't go destroying all the trees all around just to show them you're destructive. Just because you feel like destroying them. They upset you, so you want to destroy everything. You can enjoy those fruits. Why should you destroy them? And from here we learn the prohibition of Bal Tashchis. A person's not allowed to destroy unnecessarily. You're allowed to do what's necessary when you have a real benefit from it. But just to be destructive, that's prohibited. And finally, we end the parsha with the mitzvah of Egla Rufa. If a man is found murdered, we don't know who killed him, we try to verify, we can't find out. We have this whole procession of slaughtering a calf and bringing out the elders from Jerusalem. And we do this whole procession, which becomes very, very public. It rarely happened in Jewish history. And this was, the Torah says, make a big deal out of it. Someone was murdered. You make a big deal out of it, and then maybe you'll actually get information. And we'll discuss that mitzvah as well, because we learn many things from that mitzvah. So let's go over the parsha now with more depth. Our parsha begins with the mitzvah of Shoftim. Can I talk quickly? And if you find I'm talking too quickly, you'll slow me down. Is that okay? Yes? So I'm going to talk fast. And if you guys say it's too fast, tell me, okay? You could also just do this, and I'll get the hint, okay? The word shofet literally means a judge. In order for a person to be a judge in the people of Israel, he has to have smicha, he has to have rabbinic ordination. The first person to receive rabbinic ordination was Joshua. When Moshe gave Joshua rabbinic ordination, so Hashem told him, place your hand on Joshua's head. Moshe Rabbeinu put both hands on his head and leaned on him and said, you are now ordaining you the leader of the people of Israel. Because Moshe Rabbeinu leaned on him, and the word to lean on means lismoch. Lismoch in Hebrew means to lean on. So that's why every following rabbi who received rabbinic ordination, it's called that he got smicha, that his teacher leaned on him. Even though technically we don't do that anymore. Most opinions, Maimonides and others, hold that we don't put our hands on the student and lean on him and say, you are now a teacher in Israel. But we still use that term. When a person is given rabbinic ordination, they receive simicha, just like Moshe placed his hands and leaned on Joshua. Now, until about 2 millennia ago, we had real smicha, which means a person that received rabbinic ordination knew that his teacher received from someone who received, from someone who received, all the way back to Moshe at Sinai. In order to be a true judge in Israel, that's the smicha you need. Approximately 2 millennia ago, we lost that. We lost that tradition. So today, when a person receives rabbinic ordination, that certificate really says, even though technically you're not allowed to give halachic ruling in your teacher's presence, a student is not allowed to give halachic ruling. It's considered disrespectful. Your teacher's here. Why are you answering? The teacher says, I am hereby saying that he is fit to give halachic ruling. That's what the smicha says today. Rambam says an invention. We don't know where the Rambam got this from. The Rambam says, if you can get together all the leaders of the time, all the sages of the time, the great Talmidei Chachamim of the generation, and they all decide that this person is worthy of rabbinic ordination, so then that person gets smicha, and that smicha equals the original smicha. It's the same as though he would have gotten smicha from someone who has it all the way back to Moshe at Sinai. So that's a fantastic thing, Rambam writes. Guess what? In the days of Rav Yosef Karo, Rav Yosef Karo wanted to reinstate the smicha. And so he gathered the sages in Tzfat. He gathered the sages to start the smicha again. And Rav Yaakov Beirav, who Rav Yosef Karo actually values very much, even quotes him in his works, Rav Yaakov Beirav, who was considered a big rabbi at the time, went out against him. And it became a very famous machlokas. And one of the things Rav Yaakov Beirav writes him is, he says, you wanted me to be a part of this, so then obviously I count, right? You wrote me a letter saying you want me a part of your court. You want me to receive smicha from this court, right? So then I'm one of the people who are fit to be on your court. Well, I'm not joining. I don't agree with what you're doing. This was a big machlokas in the days of Rabbi Yosef Karo. Back to our parasha. So we have judges. And we are instructed that the judges have to be careful not to play favorites, not to give special treatment, not to accept a bribe. What's a bribe? A bribe is that he owes you money and he brings it a day early. That's the Talmud's example of a bribe. He was going to pay you, but he brought it a day early. That's called a bribe. The rabbis were so careful that someone who bribed them, they wouldn't judge them. There are fantastic stories. Rav Anon, the Talmud says, Eliyahu Anavi used to visit him every night. They'd learn together. And then one time, a person came and brought him a gift. And he asked the guy, why are you giving me this? And the guy said, well, it says that if you want to do the equivalent of bringing your fruits to the temple today, that we don't have a temple, you could give it to a rabbi. So I brought it to you. So he says, okay, if that's your intention, I can't argue, fine. Then the guy says, now I have a court case I want you to judge. He says, hold it, I can't judge your court case. You disqualified me from judging your court case. But you know what? There's another rabbi the next town over. I'll send you over to him. Let him judge your court case. So the guy shows up at the next rabbi and he says, Rav Anan sent me. And he shows up with the guy he's suing. And the rabbi says, gee, if Rav Anan sent you to me, then I'm going to judge you first. He was in the middle of judging orphans. We always give orphans first treatment. They get first dibs. But he said, I'm very sorry. Out of respect for Rav Anan, I got to give them the floor first. And the guy that was being sued said, forget it. If he's getting such preferential treatment, I can't say anything. I lost, right? They're letting him go first before the orphans. They're letting our case first before the orphans. There's no way I'm going to succeed. So did Rav Anan accept the bribe? No. Did Rav Anan do something wrong? On some minuscule level, he should have been slightly more careful not to allow this mistake to happen. Eliyahu doesn't show up. That's it. He lost it. Eliyahu won't come teach him Torah, and he prays and he fasts. And only after a period does Eliyahu show up again. And when Eliyahu shows up again to learn with him at night, he can't look Eliyahu in the face anymore. He has to sit in a box, and Eliyahu teaches, and he listens. Look at how careful our sages say you have to be about accepting a bribe. And that's why we have the quotes from Eliyahu that Rav Anan recorded, what he learned by Eliyahu. So the stuff he learned before he made this mistake is called Tana Debei Eliyahu Rabba, the great teachings of Eliyahu. That's when Rav Anan could look him in the face. And then what he learned the second half of his life, when he could no longer look Eliyahu in the face, that's called Tana Debei Eliyahu Zuta, the smaller teachings of Eliyahu. It's great teachings of Eliyahu, but it's when Rav Anan was a little smaller. Okay, so this is how our sages said how careful we have to be about bribes. It says we have a responsibility to pursue justice. That means when you're choosing which court you go to, you don't choose the court which you think will rule best in your favor. You choose the court that to your mind is the most honest court. Tzedek, tzedek, tildof, that's our responsibility. When we choose which judge to go to, we choose the judge that we believe will give the most accurate and true ruling. That's our responsibility. That's food for thought. You know, sometimes you have a halachic question and you tell yourself, I know that if I ask this rabbi, he'll tell me this, and that rabbi, he'll tell me that. So, okay, I'll go to the rabbi who's going to say what I want. No. You gotta look for the truth. It tells us, in this merit we will inherit the land of Israel. That's what it says throughout the prophets, that in order for Zion to be redeemed, there has to be justice. Zion was destroyed because there was no justice. We go on to the mitzvah that prohibits planting an Asherah tree. An Asherah tree is either a tree that was worshipped or a tree that they placed idols under it and they worshipped idols, but they bound the direction of the tree. Then the Torah prohibits planting on the Temple Mount. Notice how the Arabs plant all around the Temple Mount. That's prohibited. We're not allowed to plant up there. We're not allowed to have a one-stone altar. So even though Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they all made sacrifices on an altar that consisted of one large stone, when the pagans adopted that practice, God said, I don't want it. That's the same idea we find in prophets that people used to pray like this with their hands outstretched, right? But it became pagan practice that the pagan priests would stretch their hands like this in prayer. So we don't do that anymore. We don't do that. You'll see Sfardim sometimes will say, Potech et Yadecha. You ever see Sfardim do that in benching? But they won't do that as they're in prayer, raising their hands. Okay, Torah says, don't offer a blemished animal. We spoke about that a little bit. That's a concept we should think about, that we give our best. There's a story about the Rebbe of Belz or Gur, I'm not sure which one, I don't remember anymore. I think it was the Rebbe of Belz, that he had prized tefillin that he received from his grandfather, that a very holy scribe wrote those phylacteries, those tefillin, and he would only wear them on special occasions during the year. And the grandchildren were all talking about who's going to inherit those tefillin. So one day one of the grandkids comes in and he sees the tefillin are gone and he says, "Grandpa, where are the tefillin?" So he says, "Well, I gave them away." He says, "Why'd you give them away?" So he says, "Well, a poor man came to my door and he said he no longer has tefillin. So he asked me for a pair of tefillin, so I gave him those." So the grandson says, "But Grandpa, those are your holiest tefillin. Why'd you give those away?" So he said, "Because when you do a mitzvah, you do it with the best thing you have. So I had a mitzvah to do, so I took the best I had to do the mitzvah with."
Back.
I hear. Food for thought. I'll tell you an interesting story. I have a friend who had a difficult time in his parnasa. And one day I noticed that the talis he was wearing was filled with holes. He was wearing a talis that was holy, excuse the pun. So I said to him, "You know, I have an extra talis. It happens to be that at that time I had an extra talis." It turns out that I had bought a talis, started making it, put it in the closet, and forgot about it. And then I knew I needed a new talis, and I forgot I had started making one. So I went out and bought a talis, and made it, and wore it. And a few months later, I suddenly discovered the old talis, the new talis, which I hadn't finished making in the closet. So I said, "Okay, I finished making that one." And I said, "When this one wears down, okay, in a few years, I'll wear that one. It'll wait in the closet for me." So when I saw this friend with a worn-out talis, I said to him, "You know, I have a spare talis sitting in the house doing nothing. Maybe I could offer it to you." So he said, "You're sure it's spare?" I said, "Yeah, I really have nothing to do with it." So we made up. He'd come by a few hours later. I come back home, and I take out that talis, and I look at it, and it's nice. And I look at the one I'm wearing, the one I was wearing then, and it was nicer. It was, and I look at my Shabbos talis, and it was nicer. And I said to myself, "Now am I the Rebbe of Belz or not?" And I looked at the talisim and I came to the conclusion that I'm not. And when he knocked on the door, I gave him my nicest talis, and I felt bad for weeks. And every time I felt bad, I'd come to shul on Shabbos and I'd be wearing a talis and I'd look at him and he's wearing a nicer talis than I am. And I said, like you just said, I said to myself, did I do right? And it bugged me for a long time. It bugged me twice. It bugged me once because I'm human. And I saw him wearing the nicer talis and I'm wearing the whatever. And I said to myself, did I do right? But then it bugged me that it bugged me. You know, I said to myself, the Rebbe of Belz could give tefillin that he knew he'd never get back again. And I'm giving a talis which I could get back in, and it bugs me, right? So I have to work on myself. Sometimes when we try to acquire a trait, so then we act as though we have the trait, then maybe one day we'll get there. So that's not an absolute formula, because if you do everything, you'll go crazy. You could do that in one thing or two things. You can't do that in everything. If you fake it, you'll break it. You know, you can't fake it like you got every good midah under the sun, because then you'll destroy yourself. You can't be a fake your whole life. But if you take one thing or two things and you do that, so slowly you acquire those one or two things. I'm still working on it. I'm a work in progress. But it was interesting for me. You know, I had one opportunity in my life to try and live up to the Rebbe of Belz, and I said to myself, okay, that's greatness. Got to keep working. Yeah. So back to our parsha. So, yeah.
I was reading an article in one of these online newspapers, like Times Digital, like, talking about bringing like one of these part of the Bimal cows, you know, for America. So they're saying it's very hard because it's a very easy event to get moon. So how's it possible, you know, for like it seems that a very minority of animals don't have moon?
Ah, because a moon that disqualifies a para aduma, yeah, is you have to be far more gentle. Mm. A mum that disqualifies a regular animal has to be a much bigger mum. No, that's not. Yeah?
There's a story about Rabbi Ben Siona Bar Shaul of Rav Yosef Yeshiva. He was attending a wedding one time, and he didn't really care about the vehicle he was using, so one of his students had a Vespa. In Israel, back then, it was a popular vehicle. It only had a black, it had a side seat, he has a scooter, right? So in the end, that has a side seat, and the rabbi said, okay, so why we don't use that? Have you been seeing a Bashalu sentence? And the student was a little, he was not very happy with this idea, but because it's a rabbi and it's just such a vehicle. And the rabbi was riding in the on the street with his Vespa for the wedding, and people were looking at him and just pointing their fingers, what's going on? Such an important rabbi is going in such a vehicle. So when Rabbi Ben Zion de Boshaw noticed this, he told the driver to stop, and then he went, opened the back seat and went out, and then started to cry. And the student asked him why, because I didn't realize that I'm making and lessening the honor of the Torah. So there is another aspect of this. That if someone is davening with Talis, which is holy or stinky, or doesn't look good, and he's chief rabbi, what do people think about the Torah?
Okay, I hear. Back to our parsha. We have if we think about it psychologically, it's a very powerful mitzvah. It says that when witnesses testify that someone gets the death penalty, then they are the first to execute. That's very powerful. You know, it's one thing to testify, it's another thing to give the lethal injection or whichever, you know, we don't have lethal injection in Judaism, but Torah says, what happens if you're not sure what the halacha is? You go up to the high court. The high court is situated in the temple. The temple represents two things. It represents the place where we focus our prayers, and it also represents the place from which Torah emanates, or blessing, prophetic vision emanates to the world. So Rav Soloveitchik used to say that the temple is a two-way street. Prayer is man connecting to God, and Torah is God connecting to man. And on the temple, you have the high court. That's where the Sanhedrin used to sit. They had a room called Lishkat HaGazit, the room of fine stone. So if you have a question, you go to your local Orthodox rabbi. He has a question. He goes to the rabbi, the chief rabbi of the city. He has a question. He goes to the chief rabbi of the tribe. He still doesn't know the answer. You go up to the high court. When the high court gives a ruling, so sometimes their definition of Torah is biblical. Meaning in some areas they're charged with the responsibility to define the Torah, and that has biblical weight. We have a big machlokus, Rambam Ravid. When the rabbis made a rabbinic institution, let's see, we all wash hands in the morning. Is that biblical or rabbinic? Okay. What blessing do we make over washing hands in the morning? Asher kideshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al netilat yadayim. Now, what do those words mean? He, blessed are you Hashem who sanctified us and commanded us to wash our hands. Wait, did God command us to wash our hands? Okay. But did God command us to wash our hands? I thought the rabbis did. How do we make a blessing? You commanded us. Who said that? Very good. So that's what the Talmud in Tractate Shabbos and elsewhere, that's what the Talmud says, that when we make that blessing, what we mean to say is you commanded us to listen to the rabbis who told us to do this mitzvah. So when I listen to the rabbis, am I doing a biblical mitzvah? Maimonides says yes. Every time you do a rabbinic mitzvah, you light Hanukkah candles, you're doing a rabbinic mitzvah, which is also a biblical mitzvah. Torah says listen to them and don't transgress what they say. So everyone asks about Rambam, then why are we more lenient on rabbinic than biblical mitzvot, right? So a possible answer is because that the rabbis built that in. Torah says, listen to rabbis. Rabbis say, when in doubt about what we said, be lenient. Yeah, Torah says, listen to them. And they say, here's what we say, but when in doubt, be lenient. So that could be one answer. Okay, we discussed the rebellious elder. We move forward, we're up to Sheni. Should have we appointed a king or not? Well, it depends on why we want to appoint a king. If you want to appoint a king because only with a king can you lead the wars against Amalek and build the temple, that's beautiful. You should appoint a king. But if we want to appoint a king because we say we want to be like everyone else, we want to be like the nations, that's wrong. And so when we came to appoint a king, some people were saying we want to be like the nations. That was wrong. Other people were saying, we want a king. That's the way the Jewish people have to go. It's a mitzvah. It says when we enter the land of Israel, one of our mitzvot is to appoint a king, and then he leads us to war against Amalek, and then he leads the building of the temple. So that's a mitzvah. We have a mitzvah to appoint only a Jew. That was part of the issue in the Ismonian period. They appointed a servant. You know, that's why you had all the murder that was going on then. The king is not allowed to have too many horses. So we have three exceptions in our parsha. Throughout the Torah doesn't tell us why. You read the Torah, it says eat kosher. Why? Torah says don't crossbreed. Why? Torah says don't work on Shabbos. Does the Torah ever really tell us why? Sometimes the Torah says this mitzvah alludes to this concept. You keep Shabbos and you will remember that you were taken out of slavery where you worked nonstop. You keep Shabbos and you will remember I created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. But is that why you keep Shabbos? Or is that supposed to be a product of keeping Shabbos? Does the Torah ever tell us why? Yes, three times in our parsha. Torah says the king shouldn't have too many horses so that he won't bring the nation back to Egypt. Shouldn't have too many wives so that they won't mislead him. He shouldn't have too much gold and silver. He shouldn't be too haughty. So our sages say King Solomon became king, wisest of men. And he said, I could have as many horses as I want because I'll never send the people back to Egypt. I know why the Torah commanded this, and so I can have the horses and I won't transgress. I could have the wives and they won't mislead me. Our sages say he thought he was so smart and he ended up falling exactly where the Torah, the way the Torah said one would. And our sages say this is here to teach us why the Torah had to hide the reasoning of mitzvot. Because if we would know the reasons why, we would make the same mistake King Solomon did. We would say, I could do this without the Torah's mitzvah. I will transgress the mitzvah, but I'll live up to that core principle. I won't transgress the principle. And then we'll fall in the principle. And here our sages are revealing to us that there is tremendous reasoning behind every mitzvah. We don't know why. For years they were taunting us, why do you circumcise? You're mutilating the body. So today, science knows that by circumcising Jews, the Jewish people have rare, under 1% of all the cases of cancer in the male organ are Jews, are circumcised Jews. Because by circumcising, we prevent cancer in that organ. Because when people are uncircumcised, they're more prone to infection, and those infections eventually can lead to cancer. Today, we know that there are many diseases that one does not stands a far lesser risk of contracting when one is circumcised. That's why the UN sent doctors down to Africa and they circumcised for free millions, because when a person is circumcised, then they reduce the odds of contracting AIDS. They're not immune. They have reduced odds. The odds are 85% less, but you still have those 15%. It's still a possibility. It's just reduced odds. So today we see tremendous benefits in being circumcised. But you know what? For three millennia, we didn't have an answer. The nations would torment us and say, why do you do that to the children? And we would say, because God said so.
But it's not more scriptures.
Oh, so today you'll ask me, do we circumcise because it's healthy? And the answer is, I don't know. We circumcise because God said so. It could be God said so because it's healthy. It could be God said so for a million other reasons. I don't know why. God said, I'm making a covenant with you through this action. Now, why did God choose that action? He didn't tell us. So we don't know. And here you have three mitzvot where we did know why, and you see that that caused us to fall. So the king writes his own Sefer Torah, as we discussed. We're moving forward. We come to the idea of idols. So Maimonides is of the opinion that all of this was fake. The Radak quotes from the Gaonim that the sorcerers had all kinds of talents. They used to be ventriloquists. So you'd be sitting there in front of a sorcerer and you'd hear the dead talking from the ground. Yeah, you heard that because they were ventriloquists. And so one opinion says that all these actions of paganism, they were all a farce. They were all games. They fooled the people. And that's why Rambam says the Torah, when it commanded us not to go the way of the pagans, the Torah was commanding us to be intelligent people, not to believe in all of these lies. Nachmanides and other Geonim disagree. They say that's not true. There are forces out there. And one can tap into those forces. And when the pagans did it, they were tapping in. Last semester we learned the Ran. The Ran says, what do you think, the whole world was stupid? It worked. When the pagans said, this is what's going to work, and when you worship these stars this way, you'll see a benefit, they must have seen a benefit. Rambam says, yeah, you want to believe. You believe, you think you see, so you convince yourself that it worked. And when you read Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, you see that it's that way. You know, they had a storm at sea, so they said, oh no, we didn't offer a sacrifice to Zeus before we embarked. Quick, let's offer a sacrifice. They offered a sacrifice. If the waters calm down, then everyone says, you see, it worked. And if they didn't calm down, then they say, see, Zeus is so upset at us. It didn't work. We have to offer another sacrifice. Maybe we'll slaughter our firstborn son. You read books from that time. You read about how people behaved. You realize, hey, certainly sounds like Rambam. Who am I to, you know, Ramban was much closer to that time period. The Gaonim were much closer. And we have an argument that goes down the line. I'm saying this argument dates 1,500 years ago. They were arguing this. How to understand these commandments. How to understand the stories of Samuel being raised from the dead. Was it all King Saul's imagination? Or was it really happening? I'm sorry, we just got 2 minutes left. So this is an argument in all of Tanakh. It's famous, an argument, Rambam Ramban, but it predates Rambam Ramban. It was an argument centuries before them as well. The Torah says, Tamim tiyeim Hashem Elokecha. Be whole with Hashem. One of the great temptations of life is to try and corner God. We always want to corner God. So we believe if I pray fervently, I'll get what I want. Who said? The Talmud says the exact opposite. The Talmud says if a person goes into prayer and he walks out of prayer and says, I prayed so much, I'm sure God's going to give it to me. The Talmud says you could be certain you won't get it. One of the guarantees you can have that your prayer won't be answered is if you pray very hard and you're convinced your prayer will be accepted because you prayed so hard. This applies to Jews. I don't know if this applies to non-Jews. I've often said that a person should pray before they do their giyur, because our sages say that before a person is Jewish, so long as a person's not Jewish, so then Hashem says, if he prays to me, I will answer him. Because if he prays to the temple, if he prays to me, so then Hashem says, I will answer him, and even if he doesn't deserve it, because otherwise he won't believe I exist. But when a person is Jewish and he prays to Hashem, so Hashem says, if he deserves it, I'll give it to him, and if he doesn't deserve it, I won't give it to him, because he'll believe in me whether I give it to him or I won't. So I'm not going to give it to him so easily. So I've often asked people before they convert, go daven for me. Because your prayers before you're Jewish have a higher percentage of being answered than after you're Jewish. What can I do? It's what our sages say. Okay? So back to our parsha. So the Torah says, Tamim tiyeim Hashem. Be whole with Hashem. That means accept the fact that he's running the show, even though you don't know where it's headed. We're so tempted. We always want to know. That's why people look for amulets. Right? What's the idea of an amulet? This is a way of cornering God. It's a skula, guaranteed. You do this, go daven at the Kotel 40 days, you'll get what you wanted. Really? Then why didn't other people know this? Why was the temple destroyed? They didn't pray at the temple for 40 days? They didn't know this secret? Only we know this secret? Does that really work? Does that make sense? Do we find in the Torah that that works? You could pray for 40 days at the Kotel, I have no problem, But to believe that if that's what you're going to do, for sure your prayers will be answered. Well, the Talmud says that's not the way it works. Tamim tiyeim Hashem, be whole with Hashem. The Rama in Shulchan Aruch quotes this often. He quotes this in different places with our amulets that he says, maybe this is okay, but why would you go this route, he says. Be whole with Hashem. Recognize that he runs the show, even though we don't know where he's taking us. We don't know. We don't have answers to all our questions.